You're listening to KZYX 90.7 FM Philo and KZYZ 91.5 FM Willits and Ukiah and 88.3 FM Fort Bragg. Also streaming on the internet at www.kzyx.org. This is Mendocino County Public Broadcasting, listener-supported community radio. Coming up next, it's Point and Click Radio, the weekly computer show.
Welcome to another edition of Point and Click Radio. I'm Bob Lawton.
And I'm Jim Hyde.
And tonight, Point and Click is brought to you in part by our members and the Homestyle Cafe, where good cooking comes first, a locally owned and operated family restaurant serving traditional American made-from-scratch recipes. They're open till 2 p.m. for breakfast and lunch on Main Street in Fort Bragg. They're in the gray A-frame building just north of the Noyo Bridge over in Fort Bragg.
Yeah, and we thank them, and we also thank the folks at the Mendocino Community Network for supporting our streaming endeavors. This edition of Point and Click Radio, like all editions of Point and Click Radio, and like all of KZYX's news and public affairs programming, is being streamed on the internet. If your radio reception's not quite up to snuff, or you've got a friend in a faraway place who might like to listen in, tell them to go to www.kzyx.org. where they can find the link to the live stream to listen to not only this show but also all of KZYX's news and public affairs programming.
That's right. Yeah, we're live around the world.
That's it.
Yeah. So, welcome back.
It's good to be back. Thank you.
We had a heck of a pledge drive.
Yeah. You scored big time last week. Nice job.
I think it was the guilt contingent.
Guiltware, nagware. Well, hey, that's sometimes what it takes.
That was it. I mean, I was shocked.
Shocked
that people weren't paying and renewing their memberships. But they came through, and I really want to thank everybody
who contributed
to the membership renewal and new member pledge drive we had over the last more than 10 days.
Yeah.
But it's good. We almost made our goals, and in these tight times, that's pretty respectable.
That's pretty good.
So, we've got some news, a little bit of news from Washington, D.C., where the Justice Department is continuing their Microsoft antitrust case. Just one little interesting tidbit. Despite the objections of Microsoft, the U.S. District Judge Colleen Kolar-Cotelli said she would allow the nine states seeking the sanctions against Microsoft to have a demonstration by a computer expert of a version of Windows that can be customized, which Microsoft is protesting cannot be done, although somehow somebody let it slip that there is a modular version of Windows that's used for things like gas pumps, cash registers.
Yes. Scary concept, yes. Really, on both fronts.
It really is. So anyway, that's the next in the more than, what, 4 years old now?
Yeah.
Microsoft saga, the antitrust trial. Of course, we had a small change in administrations there.
And right.
The tack is somewhat different. The only thing holding up Microsoft's total world domination at this point is the fact that nine, what do they call them?
States attorneys general.
Yeah, but they had a name for that club of people that just don't get how good Microsoft software is.
The smart ones, I think.
Nine states, including our own of California.
That's right.
Want to see this case pursued the way an antitrust case normally would and should be pursued.
Yeah, yeah, and yesterday's development is kind of funny. It's just yet another example. Some Microsoft critics would say of Microsoft talking out of both sides of its mouth.
Yeah.
Where on the one hand saying no, we couldn't take Internet Explorer out of Windows; it would completely break it, and it's all tied in and interwoven into the operating system. But on the other hand, they say, oh, well, we have this Windows XP embedded, this modular version of Windows that we can put together. And, well, apparently a former Microsoft employee has said, well, yeah, sure, I can put together a version of Windows that doesn't have a browser in it and that doesn't have a media player in it,
right.
And I'll use this modular version. So,
despite the objections of Microsoft, the judge is going to let it fly, and
yeah.
So we'll see.
Indeed.
Apparently, though, this last time, Bill Gates actually testified live in the courtroom.
Yeah.
And the reviews coming in said he did an unbelievably skillful job.
He was apparently well-coached this time around.
I guess.
They probably made him watch his last round of testimony in front of a, you know, the same guy who's talking to the Enron board of directors now, the same testimony coach, gave him some lessons in how not to sneer to the judge, and yes, his apparently he was knowledgeable, he was respectful, he showed proper deference to the court.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing what money will buy these days, isn't it?
Good acting lessons.
Yeah. We got some other news.
We do have some other news. And before we get into the other news, we should tell the folks why we're getting through the news so quickly
so
tonight, because this is kind of a special show.
Yeah. We have a guest waiting patiently on the phone, and his name is Brian Tiemann. That's Tiemann. Brian is originally from Mendocino County. He now lives down and works down in Silicon Valley. And he's an expert on the Unix platform, in particular the flavor of Unix called FreeBSD. And he's the co-author of a new book from Sam's Publishing called FreeBSD Unleashed.
And it's a megapage
my
book.
My fingers are straining just to span the depth of this book.
Yes.
It is one humongous, comprehensive book. And so we're going to have Brian on in just a couple of minutes. And we're going to be talking about FreeBSD, Unix in general, all the different flavors of Unix, including Mac OS X, which now has Unix-like underpinnings. And we're also going to open the phone lines later for people who might want to call in questions about this. But Brian is Brian's a great fan of open source and free software. So we're going to be getting some subtle distinctions about what's free software, what's open source software, and a lot of those issues. And it's very timely to have somebody on with this level of expertise.
Yeah, and it's great that there's a local angle as well.
Yeah.
So that's coming up in just a couple of minutes. As soon as we wrap up the last news items and the news from the Macintosh world, well, there's quite a bit. Macintosh users got their preview of the next major version of Mac OS X, codenamed Jaguar. This week, Apple CEO Steve Jobs keynoting the Apple Worldwide Developer Conference, which is a big shindig that Apple has every year around this time, for its software developers to kind of part the curtain and show them what's coming up in the Macintosh world and get them all fired up about developing for the Mac. Well, this time around, he demoed Mac OS X version 10.2. It's scheduled to be available, quote, by the end of the summer.
Uh-huh.
So we'll see it around September 20th.
They like to use that sort of phraseology in determining time scales.
Yes, it's good. Now, it's good. And they didn't specify which year, but we can assume that it's 2002.
Right. Now, is that when the kids when the kids in the junior colleges go back to school in the middle of August, or is it when the leaves on the trees are all red and yellow at the end of October?
I think it's before the autumnal equinox in one form or another.
Yeah.
And version 10.2 will have some interesting new features, among them a handwriting recognition technology called Inkwell.
Oh.
And this is kind of neat. You know, Apple was kind of a pioneer, the kind of pioneer with the arrows in its back, way
yeah.
back when it introduced the first Newton, and it didn't exactly do the best job of writing the edition, which
yeah.
is a more or less translation of how the Newton would read, would recognize your handwriting.
And if I remember, it made it into Dune, which is pretty
yes.
much a
dubious distinction
yes.
indeed. And what that's going to mean to the Macintosh platform, to Apple's plans for doing maybe a handheld computer or some kind of a tablet computer down the road, we can only speculate, but it's a pretty safe bet that they've got some kind of plans like that in the works. 10.2 will also have a new chat instant messaging program called iChat. And I personally am not a fan of instant messaging software at all. To me, it combines the worst of the telephone and the worst of email. It's like yeah. phone intrusions with lots of typing.
Yes.
but certainly I not everybody shares that sentiment. Millions upon millions of people use this stuff, and there will now be a chat client built into Mac OS X.
I guess it's real popular with mall rats.
I think so.
Like that,
I think the kids really like it.
Yeah, yeah.
and a bunch of other features. One of the most interesting, as far as I'm concerned, is faster performance. I'm a big, big, big fan of Mac OS X. I am using it full time
at too.
Home, and very rarely have to go into Classic now that all the apps that I rely on, all the programs that I rely on, are available for Mac OS X. But I wish it was a little bit faster.
Yeah.
And supposedly 10.2 is going to be dramatically faster. At the graphics engine is reportedly greatly revamped.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of new kind of industry standard under the hood kinds of things, enhanced networking protocols, and new networking stuff. Something that Apple is calling Rendezvous, which apparently will just kind of help Macs find each other on networks when you boot them up and all that. So
that can be very hard if you're in a...
It can be a real pain. Yeah. And it will be built around FreeBSD 4.4, this article that I am reading says. So it'll be interesting to get our guests' take on that.
Yeah.
And also a little... So that's later this year, summer, late summer, early fall. A little more immediately, Apple today, just this morning, released iPhoto version 1.1.
Re-released.
A new, 1.1.1, yes. There was an iPhoto 1.1 out for about 12 minutes.
12 minutes, yeah, until somebody discovered it erased everything.
Yeah, and boy, I hope that they're, I thought that they'd learned their lesson after the iTunes disaster of last November, when a lot of users found
yeah.
their hard drives instantly blankened.
Well, I think Steve probably pulled somebody's heart out of their rib cage, and then they went back to their programming.
Yes, yes. So anyway, iPhoto 1.1 is out there. It's available. It's free. It runs only under Mac OS X, and it's the spoke of the Apple Digital Hub that handles all the digital photography stuff,
yeah.
downloading pictures from your camera and making albums and printing photos.
And it only works under Mac OS X.
It only works under 10.
And it's an absolutely beautiful piece of software.
It's really nice.
For a 1.0 release of anything, it's got to be one of the...
Yeah, it's a gem.
One of the all-time greats.
It's a gem. And 1.1.1 is even nicer. It's got some nice new features. And if you're into digital photography at all, you should check it out, because it's just one of those programs that just makes the whole process of dealing with the images just so much easier.
If you are using Mac OS X, and especially if you have a fast internet connection, and you're not in the habit of doing this, you might want to go into your, I keep wanting to say control panels, but they're not.
System preferences.
System preferences, and check into your automatic updating
yeah.
feature.
Yeah.
because it's actually pretty convenient. And I think it doesn't it also let you know the order that you have to do them in, because there is
in some case yes okay. in some cases yeah if you have to do a if you have to install one thing before you can install another one it will tell you that, or it won't give you the option of installing the second thing until you've installed the first thing.
Ah, okay. So it kind of keeps track of that. It's a way to do a little bit of housekeeping on your upgrades. And also, it has another feature. If you keep being pestered to upgrade your Canon printer drivers and you don't have and never plan to get a Canon printer, you can tell it to stop stop nagging on that.
Yeah, yeah. Like the Portuguese language upgrade kits and things like that, which boy, I haven't used for weeks.
Yeah, yeah. There was one other announcement from WWDC, the developers conference, and I want to get right to our guest. I was surprised to hear that they were talking about a rack mount server. I mean, where are they going with this?
This is supposed to be something that's going to be announced next week, an Apple rack-mountable server, something that would, you know, rather than being one of those beautiful plastic translucent orbs that's going to be in the Museum of Modern Art someday, this is something that's 18 inches wide and is going to slide into a rack inside of a piece of equipment, inside of a server room,
inside
a computer
room.
Inside
of a closet.
In a closet. So it'll be interesting to see if Apple tries to make it look beautiful.
Okay, he's Jim Hyde, I'm Bob Lawton, we're Point and Click, and we've got Brian Thiemann on the phone, and without further ado, Brian's been patiently waiting, and we're going to bring him up on the air. Hello, Brian.
Hi, good to be here.
Oh,
hi,
yeah, good to be back here. You're from Mendocino County.
Yes, indeed, I'm from Redwood Valley.
Redwood Valley, my hometown.
Oh, wow.
My adopted hometown. Did you grow up here?
Every day of the first 18 years of my life, yeah.
Wow, all right, wow. Yeah. Well, welcome back over the airwaves and the internet, and... we're glad to have you here.
Yes. It's good to be in the company of fellow Mac OS X fans.
Yeah, we were going to talk about that, but before we talk about Mac OS X, let's talk a little bit about how you came to write this book, and why don't you just give us a little bit of background about how you came to be in the field of computers in the first place?
Well, it's a long story, and it travels throughout my whole experience of school and just I started out with an old Apple IIc Plus and just worked my way up through a DOS machine, a Windows machine, and through college was introduced to Unix because that's just what everybody used on the campus network. You know, it's the way the students get around. And at the time, 1994, when I got to college, that was the only way to do email. That was the only way to do news groups and chatting and any kind of the stuff we take for granted these days.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's true. I mean, the web only debuted in a very limited way in 1992, I think.
94, or late 93, actually.
Yeah.
And at the time, the only browser available was Mosaic, and it was in quite a sorry state at the time because it only worked on Unix workstations, which meant that, you know, it was kind of unheard of that Windows would ever be on the Internet, as you might say.
Yeah.
And at the time, you'd use Mosaic on an HP UX machine, and it could only display GIF images in line. If you had JPEGs, it would have to fire up an external viewer.
Wow.
Just to view those.
Man. We sure have come a long way.
Yeah. I had no idea how to handle those. So, but then while I was at college, I got to see the entire formative first years of the Internet. I put up some web pages. I ran a few fan servers for various things, movies and so forth, developed a bunch of skills just running those things, just trying to add features to the system.
Yeah, I should mention to people, I believe you have the premier Lion King tribute website.
Yeah, lionking.org.
Okay. And that's been up for quite a while in web years.
Since the beginning of 1995.
Amazing.
And that's a long time.
Yeah.
And it just keeps growing in popularity, too, much to my chagrin, because I got to pay for the bandwidth.
I guess that's it.
But yeah, that one side effect of that is that I got to meet a lot of people who wanted accounts on the server, and one of them happened to be Michael Urban, my co-author, who he got an account and he looked around and said, "Hey, this is a FreeBSD machine," which I was running. I started running FreeBSD back in 1995 or so because it just seemed attractive at the time.
So FreeBSD has been around that long? Huh?
It's been around since the early 90s.
Uh-huh.
It's a variant on the various BSDs, which I'll talk about a little later. But
yes.
But yeah, at the time it just seemed attractive because it had a nice floppy-based install. You put a floppy disk in with a piece of boot software, and it would go out and install the entire OS over the internet for you.
Huh.
So I thought that was neat.
And that is.
And also at the time, I was working at Pacific Internet in Ukiah, and I'd used it a couple of times there to set up some web servers and had good experiences. So I'd set up this server of my own using FreeBSD. And at the time, Michael Urban got his account, looked around, and said, "Hey, this is a pretty well-run system," and contacted me and said, "Hey, you know, I've written some books in the past, some technical journals, manuals, and right now I'm on the line to write something called FreeBSD Unleashed for SAMS, and it looks like too big of a project for me to do on my own. You know, it's over 1,000 pages.
Uh-huh.
And would you like to go in on it half and half?" So I thought, hey, why not? You know, it's a it sounds like a fun thing to add to my resume.
Sure.
Yeah, totally. So he already had the contract and brought you in as his co-author?
Right. So which meant we got to cut all our money in half.
Right.
But it was also cutting the work in half. And for 3 months of writing, that's a lot of pages.
Yeah. Even,
especially if you're the only one doing it, writing 1,000 pages in 3 months.
That's pretty daunting.
I wouldn't want to try it.
No.
Yeah.
It was, it involved a lot of work just as it was.
So for our listeners who may not be familiar with FreeBSD, we have done shows in the past on Linux, and so a lot of our listeners are familiar with kind of what Linux is and how it fits into the grand scheme of operating systems. Can you talk a little bit from a layperson's standpoint about what FreeBSD is and where it's popular and kind of why it's important, basically?
Well, you might think of FreeBSD as a cousin of Linux in the sense that it's the cousin you never hear about, but eventually he appears in the newspapers as running for public office or something. It tends to be a more industrial kind of OS, and it's less flashy. It gets less press, but it's every bit as advanced in many ways as Linux is. It just doesn't tend to wave the banner as much, so you don't hear about it quite to the same degree. Now, sites that use it are like Yahoo uses it, Hotmail uses it, oddly enough. In fact, that's kind of a scandalous story from Microsoft. They had a bunch of Solaris and FreeBSD machines, and they ran all of their Hotmail accounts on it up until a couple years ago when they tried to move everything over to Windows 2000, and it could not hold up under the load even in the slightest.
I heard those on some of the rumors and news sites. So that was FreeBSD they were running.
Yeah, FreeBSD and Solaris in about an even mix. I'm not really sure what they're used for respectively, but right now it's known that not all of the FreeBSD machines have been eradicated from the Hotmail network.
Now, that's funny.
Yeah, and also there was that sort of funny story about the what was it called? The Unisys and Microsoft had a partnership where they wanted people to dump their Unix systems and go into a Windows-based enterprise system using the Unisys software over the Microsoft platform.
WeHaveTheWayOut.com.
That's it. WeHaveTheWayOut.com.
Yes.
And that site was run on?
It was run on FreeBSD, as I recall.
Yes. And then they instantly switched it over to I think the Microsoft IIS server.
As soon as they realized people could find this out.
Yes.
It's amazing that, you know, they didn't know that. Hadn't anybody been to serverwatch.com or anything like that where you can go out and find out what kind of server a website is being delivered on? It's just...
What they rely on is people not really digging under the surface.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a foolish assumption in Microsoft's case, because there's a whole subculture of people who live just to expose delightful little nuggets like that.
Uh-huh. That's what marketing's all about.
Yeah, that's right. So,
I should talk about what makes FreeBSD different from Linux, too.
Yeah, indeed.
To speak in the strictest sense, Linux is only Unix-like. It's not really a Unix. And what makes a system a Unix is that it must be derived from the actual code tree that was developed by Bell Labs back in the late 70s. Mm. And at the time, what happened was that Bell Labs was writing this software, and they contracted it out to the University of Berkeley, who further developed it on a different branch. The history of Unix is a gigantic mess, and to put it into a nutshell would take longer than an hour. But get the very basic summary of it all would be to say that BSD split off from the the main branch of Unix development back in about 1978, excuse me.
So the original development of Unix was AT&T, right?
Right, AT&T and Bell Labs.
Starting around 1970.
Right.
And then they contracted Cal Berkeley to do what?
To further develop it and to make it a commercially viable system.
Okay.
And that's what the Berkeley Software Distribution was.
That's what BSD stands
right.
for, Berkeley
that's
Software
BSD.
Distribution, yeah. And so was there like a split in the family tree at that point?
Yeah, and so Unix itself, the stuff that Bell Labs was writing, became its own branch of the tree, and you'll hear it referred to today as System 5.
Okay.
So certain systems will be System 5-like, and certain systems will be BSD-like. And that has to do with how the items in the OS are structured and just how it operates in general. There's just a lot of different philosophical guiding principles for how each one works.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Now, BSD eventually became open sourced and ported to the Intel platform, and it split into three prongs. Those are OpenBSD, NetBSD, and FreeBSD. OpenBSD is mostly security related. It's supposed to be the most secure OS there is. NetBSD is all about running on every platform imaginable. You can run it on your Sega Dreamcast. You can run it on
on your Palm Pilot.
Yeah, everything.
Okay.
And FreeBSD is supposed to be the front runner as far as features go, ease of use goes, and so forth. So about the same time that FreeBSD became started being heavily developed, Linux was also under development, it was developed as a Unix-like clone with completely free software underneath it, which means I should get into the differences between the BSD license and the GNU license.
Well, this is an important and significant point because both of these, Linux and FreeBSD, are both basically free to anybody, right?
True. The source is freely available. You can get the source code. You can make your own changes to it. You can do whatever you want to it.
But there's a significant difference in the way the licenses are written. Even though you don't have to pay money for it, you have to follow certain principles when you're implementing the software, right?
Right.
And you seem to have a fair amount of knowledge in that. When I talked to you on the phone earlier, Brian,
you talked about
that. What is the difference between Linux and FreeBSD as far as the lawyers are concerned?
The two licenses, BSD and the GPL, which used to be called the GNU Public License, now they're referring to it as the General Public License. So you have the BSD and the GPL licenses. The difference is that the former, BSD, says all the code is freely available for this. A piece of software that's released under this license says the code is available with it for anybody to use. And you can then take that and incorporate it into any other product. You can rewrite it. You can add features to it. You can put it in a product and charge money for it. And you don't have to do anything else. You're not obligated to do anything further. You can sell your product and do anything you like. But the GPL has a further stipulation, which is that you have to also release your modified source code along with the product.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more free in a sense, and it's less free in another sense. It's forced freedom. It's required freedom.
Yes, right.
So,
okay.
And for some people, it's more attractive. For some, it's less.
Yeah, it's forced freedom free.
Yeah, I mean the GPL stuff is being pushed mostly by the Linux advocates, Richard Stallman and so forth. They are very idealistic and say that you must release the software and the source to it, no matter what you do with it, and essentially that you cannot ever really make any money off software. But the BSD license doesn't have that stipulation, so that companies like, for instance, Apple, can take BSD license code, incorporate it into products that they then charge money for, and make a business case based on that.
So I guess Microsoft could do that too, couldn't they?
They can. That's right. In fact, there's been a lot of talk about whether Microsoft would go and make a distribution of Linux or a distribution of or their own flavor of BSD. But of course, one has to imagine that to do that would be admitting all the FUD they've been you know, fear, uncertainty, and doubt they've been spreading about open source and Unix in general is not true.
Right. Now, I believe one very, very little known and very seldom mentioned fact is that, in fact, Microsoft actually did make their own version of Unix a long, long, long time ago.
It was Xenix, wasn't it?
They called it Xenix.
Yeah.
And, you know, after they got DOS, which they didn't write originally, if I believe, mm-hmm. then they went and made their own version of Unix. But I'm not sure what eventually happened to that.
Unix only lasted a few years. Uh-huh. Apparently it didn't catch on.
Yeah.
There's a lot of flavors of Unix out there that didn't, that never really caught on. Because the thing about Unix is that it's developed in an academic environment usually.
Yes.
And so certain flavors of it are commercially targeted, and certain other flavors just never really are sold. They're not intended for that.
They just kind of work behind the scenes and do their job, and yeah. And never see the you know, a full page ad in the back cover of Newsweek.
That's right.
Right. Yes. Oh.
Yeah, I love that ad that Apple just put out that said macOS 10 sends other operating systems to Dev Null.
Oh yes, yes, that's a cute ad. That's
I haven't seen that yet.
I've seen it in Scientific American.
Is it current this week?
It's a two page spread with titanium in the center with the, you know, the Unix console and terminal and other, you know, Unix utilities up there, and it says, yeah, macOS 10 sends other Unix boxes to Dev Null.
No, Dev Null. Okay, an inside joke.
Yes, a Unix humor.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, you know what, Brian? We're getting a lot of, I hate to interrupt this radio broadcast, we're getting a whole lot of static from your phone connection on this end.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so I'm going to take a quick break here, and I'm just going to call you right back.
Okay.
So we'll be back in just a couple of minutes here with Brian Thiemann, and we should mention that...
This is Point and Click Radio, the weekly computer show on KZYX and Z, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. And I guess one of the key things that I want to discuss with Brian when we get him back on the line is getting into the worlds of free and open source software. Because for most of our listeners, for most of us, we are not going to be using free BSD, or at least interacting with it on a direct level.
Not up close and personal.
No, it may very well be one of those operating systems that is running behind the scenes on a web server, on a website that we visit. But yeah, it's not something that most of us are going to be using and double clicking on and using for our day-to-day computing. However, a lot of the underlying kind of philosophical concepts behind free BSD, of open source software and free software, are becoming very much mainstream concepts in the computer world, and it's now possible to get free Photoshop clones or free clones of Microsoft Office that are open source and have a lot of the same capabilities as those commercial programs.
Which reminds me, we want to talk to Brian about that interesting thing that happened down in Peru.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. That's right.
So we'll be back in just a half a second as soon as we get Brian up on hopefully a better phone connection. We are the robots. We are the robots. Are you back there, Brian?
I'm back.
Okay. There he is.
That sounds much better.
All right.
Yes. Where were we?
Well, one thing that I mentioned that I would be interested in getting into is a broader discussion of kind of the free and open source movement. As I mentioned when we were redialing, for most of our listeners, are not going to be using FreeBSD for their general day-to-day computing. They may well be encountering it when they go out and hit a website, or if they're macOS 10 users, they'll be at least using it to some extent, you know, as their underpinnings. But a lot of the basic kind of philosophical concepts behind FreeBSD have now made their way into other aspects of the computing scene, some of which may be very directly, some of which our listeners may very directly encounter, like open source and free software. So can you talk a little bit about kind of the differences between the two and kind of just where all that stands these days?
Well, between open source and free, that's a semantic point that is still under a lot of debate, especially as if you remember that Peruvian flap from a few days ago, where Microsoft was trying to get the Peruvian government to back down on its statement that it was going to use only open source software in its government systems. And then Dr. Nunez, I believe it was, of the Congress of Peru, wrote back this gigantic long letter, just surgically tearing the heart out of Microsoft's boilerplate that tries to discredit open source.
Yeah, they weren't ready for that, were they?
No, not at all.
And now, according to what I read on my favorite worldwide IT news source, The Register, the letter is purportedly from the congressman. Is it in fact? Has anybody verified that?
I don't know.
Okay. It seems too well written to be a prank.
Yeah. I mean, if it's a prank, it's valid nonetheless.
Yes. Yeah. We should mention that one of the bits of fallout from the free source, open source free software movement is a lot of countries that are less prosperous than the United States and some of the Western European nations are seriously considering using free and open source software for their systems, for their computing systems, and basing them on programs like Linux and FreeBSD. And Microsoft, I believe, is in at least a couple cases actively lobbying against this, saying that, for example, if you don't have software that you have to charge money for, you won't get tax returns, in terms of taxes on commercial proprietary software.
The funniest thing they claim is that if you don't go with commercial software, you can't have any security. And they turn around and say, well, no, look, first of all, there is some of the least secure out there.
Yeah.
The entire point of open source software is that you can see the code, you can see every bit of it. So if anybody's put a backdoor in, you can see it.
Yeah.
You know, it's much less secure to have a bunch of binary precompiled code where you have no idea whether there's some kind of security hole in there just waiting to be exploited.
And in fact, there's been numerous dozens of backdoors, traps, security holes, and leaks that have been identified in Microsoft's very own software.
Yeah, so that's clearly a marketing point that they try to use on people who aren't fully informed, but in this case, they really got bitten.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, so the Microsoft representative down in Peru, I guess, wrote a letter, kind of a, like you said, boilerplate to the Peruvian government saying, you better reconsider using open source software, and then this was I guess it was fairly politely written.
Oh, yeah.
But it was very, very...
It was certainly in a lot more detail than the original letter from Microsoft.
Right. It was a very logical and fluid discourse, including three points, which I'll mention right now. The basic principles which inspired this bill, it's a bill with a capital B, but not Bill as in Bill Gates,
right.
Bill as in a legislative bill, are linked to the basic guarantees of a state of law, such as 1, free access to public information by the citizen, 2, permanence of public data, and 3, security of the state and citizens. And I guess his point was that...
Microsoft fails on all three counts.
Fails on all three counts. Okay. Yeah.
There you have it.
So I wanted to sort of direct our conversation back into the question that Jim asked about... most of us probably will never have the pleasure or the challenge of installing FreeBSD, which I should mention comes bundled with your book. There are not one, but 2, is it, CDs?
Yeah, as I recall, there's a copy of FreeBSD 4.5, or 4.4, is it? I think 4.4, which is the most recent full version, and there's also another version, which is 5.0.
Yeah.
It's a pre-release.
So this book is very large and heavy and awesome and comes with not one but 2 CDs.
And the book we're talking about, for folks who may have just tuned in, is called FreeBSD Unleashed. We are talking by phone with one of its co-authors, Brian Thiemann. A Redwood Valley native, and so we were talking about kind of open source and free software. Now there are a growing number of I mean, there have always been kind of freeware utilities out there. You know, somebody creates a little, a nice little utility and puts it up on an online service and people download it and it's freeware. But what we're talking about here kind of goes beyond that, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, well, first of all, the open source that you're talking about is not just that you don't have to pay for the software. It's that the source code is also available.
It's the recipe for the software is also published.
So if you want to, you can be ingenious and download the source code and make your own changes to it and come up with a new version. And
that's one of the beauties kind of the open source movement, where it is this kind of collaborative community where, you know, somebody releases a piece of software as open source, therefore the recipe, the source code is available, other programmers will look at it, they'll make improvements, and so a piece of software kind of evolves and grows through the combined efforts of this community as opposed to through the efforts of, you know, programmers laboring in their cubicles under the whip of a product manager who wants to add more bullet points to the back of the box for the next version.
Yeah, right. And this happens worldwide 24 hours a day because it all happens thanks to the internet.
I like it. I like to liken it to music, in that with music you're free to create whatever you like, music wise, and then just release it. But it goes beyond that. With music, you're still limited to distribution, at least in a pre-MP3 kind of sense. You have to go and you have to get record deals and you have to do the recording somehow, which costs money. But with software, the neat thing is that there is no overhead. You can write software, especially if you have the developer tools, which are free, for Linux and FreeBSD, just the GCC compiler and whatever other tools you might need. They're all freely available. You can write whatever you like. It's limited only by the ingenuity of the programmer. And then once the program has been created, all you have to do is post it on some web board somewhere, which can be done for free, and suddenly everybody in the world knows about his breakthrough product.
Now, is there a central website for FreeBSD?
It's freebsd.org, yeah.
And is that where all the development and code postings and all that kind of stuff happens?
Right. One difference between FreeBSD and Linux that I should mention is that FreeBSD is a complete operating system. And Linux really...
Well, that's true.
In the strictest sense, Linux is just the kernel.
Well, that's the part that Linus Torvalds created, right?
Right, and Linus is still in charge of the kernel. He's the main figurehead, the main guy everything goes through. But the way that the operating system is packaged, Linux is... It exists in the form of dozens of different distributions.
Well, the kernel would be kind of like the engine of a car, right?
Right.
And then to have a complete car, you need a lot more than just the engine. You need the wheels and the transmission.
It's like the way sports cars were done in the 60s. You'd have an engine done by Ferrari, and then you'd farm it out to a bunch of different coach builders. You know, Zagato would make some, and
Pininfarina, and other people. Yeah,
they would all be contracted to do certain shells to put around it.
So there is no real Linux operating system. There's a kernel, and then these different, I guess they're called distributions, make the actual OS.
Right, so Red Hat makes a distribution, and Slackware makes a distribution, Caldera. They're all their own different versions of the entire operating system.
And there's even some versions that are compiled for Mac OS, pre-OS 10, I guess.
Yeah, because it doesn't matter whether you have another OS on there or not. It's because you can dual boot any machine.
Sure.
And so there are some versions of Linux that will run on any current Mac, really.
Oh, okay.
Install it. Yellow Dog Linux is the front runner right now.
Yeah.
So if FreeBSD is a complete operating system, how does it interrelate with Apple's Mac OS X?
Well, remember I talked about OpenBSD and NetBSD. Mm-hmm. Those are also complete operating systems. Maybe not quite as feature complete as FreeBSD, but they do everything. You install it, and it all comes from the same code base. It all comes from the same central distribution point. Mac OS X is based on another variant of BSD called Darwin, mm-hmm. and that is pretty much the same kind of idea as FreeBSD. It's a command line based Unix derivative that will. It's fully functional as a separate operating system. But Mac OS X, the operating system that you'll use just sitting in front of your computer, that all the graphical stuff that you see, that sits on top of Darwin.
I see.
And talks to it through various API layers.
Hmm.
So OS X, you can open up the terminal, and when you're on the console, you are effectively using Darwin. But everything outside of the terminal is the operating system that lies on top of it.
Well, Darwin isn't that the name that Apple gave to that operating system?
Yeah, I believe so. Apple is the main force behind the development of Darwin.
Okay, and Darwin itself is open source, is that
right?
Not correct?
It is fully open source. That's where the split occurs. Darwin's source is fully available in its current state. You can make changes, you can submit it back, and it's actually a separate working group, not Apple itself. It's fully in charge of it.
But they kind of split off and gave it to a different group,
right? But Mac OS X, the stuff that runs on top of Darwin, that's closed source. It's commercial software that the source does not leave one infinite loop in Cupertino.
Right, yeah.
In other words, it's the kind of thing that a lot of the really strict open source people will find a lot of things to complain about. They say, no, you have to release the source for everything from top to bottom. Mm.
But still, it seems to be getting pretty popular with people who were tended to favor Unix-based systems rather than proprietary operating systems.
People are realizing that open source is not a complete answer, and even the ones who are the most rabid about it still realize that there's got to be a compromise made, and Mac OS X is a really great compromise. Now, one thing I wanted to say is that I've always been in favor of open source for things like server applications, web servers, FTP servers, the kinds of things that are infrastructural to the nature of the internet. But open source.
Why is that, Brian?
Because open source software, it lends itself to that kind of development. What you're doing with software like Apache, the web server, is you are trying to adhere to a standard and perform a function as extensively, as completely, as securely as possible. And open source is really great at doing that because you have all these people auditing the code all the time. But on the other hand, I am not such a great fan of open source on the desktop for everything, because for consumer software, for software that you have to use that's user-friendly, open source is not a great model for that. Now, the reason is that open source tends to be driven by people who are very individualistic and rebel-like, rebellious.
That would be Richard Stallman, for example?
Yeah, but for that matter, it would be like anybody who espouses the ideals of open source. What they're doing is they're rebelling against the status quo of Microsoft and whatever else is the commercial standard right now. They say that they have a better idea, they have a different ideal, a different vision of what computing should be. And so they all will do their own thing. And the trouble with that is that when you have a lot of people all stirring the same pot, they all start to have disagreements with each other, they start to stir different pots, and that's where you start getting these splits between...
This inevitably happens. It happens on internet news groups probably every hour on the hour.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there'll be flame wars, there'll be trolls, there'll be all that kind of stuff that tends to work against the harmony of those community types of efforts.
Yeah, if you've ever looked at any discussions on Slashdot, you know exactly what I mean.
Yeah, totally.
Everybody knows they have the answer, and if every one of these people starts their own initiative to develop, you know, GNOME is one great example, and KDE is another great example. They're both very idealistic implementations of a full desktop environment.
Yeah,
but they are for the benefits of those who aren't really familiar with it. They're both graphical shells.
They would be like the equivalent of Windows,
right? Yeah,
on a Unix-based system.
Yeah, it gives you the icons and the windows and the menus
system
and all that stuff.
Yeah,
right. And they both split apart because they couldn't agree with each other on the various ideals of how these things should be implemented. Same with Enlightenment and a bunch of other similar kinds of efforts.
There were even some former developers from the original Macintosh project that got together and tried to make a graphical interface for Linux.
Yes. Easel.
Easel. Easel. Right, yeah.
And fortunately, Easel.
Easel
and
collapsed.
The product Nautilus, yeah. Andy Hertzfeld, who was one of the original Mac OS UI gurus, was a big part of Easel. And unfortunately, they just trying to do it to, do it to write software for open source people who tend to not want to pay money for their software, can be a kind of a contentious business plan at best.
Yeah, and then the combination of that and then Mac OS X coming out with all of a sudden, you know, the same kind of robust open source underpinnings, but with a nice, you know, fairly refined interface and all this backward compatibility in it. I think that was probably the final nail for them, unfortunately.
Yeah, they have Mac OS X has, because this is designed by one company with one guiding vision, they say, here's what everything is supposed to look like. Here is how all the widgets are supposed to work together. Then everything looks like that. Everything suggests the same kind of functionality, and everything's intuitive.
Yeah.
And here's the big secret. software like iMovie and iTunes, those are extremely simple to use, but they don't come from open source, because open source people don't think that way. They think in terms of complete functionality, not making any compromises, and mostly writing for people who aren't necessarily newbies.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it tends to be an in-group, I think.
Right.
So to use our car metaphor again, you know, the open source world might indeed be best for building things like engines, where you know the combustion process has to take place, and you want it to take place as efficiently as possible. But it might not be so good for designing things like the interior of the car, because everyone might have their own tastes or ideas of, you know, what the upholstery ought to look like and where the controls ought to be located.
Yes, right. Exactly.
Not everybody wants a front seat that's 12 inches wide. Or an SUV.
Precisely.
Yeah. Brian, I have one quick question that I've been dying to know a little more about. You might be the person to help me answer this. And then I would like, in our remaining 10 minutes, to open the phones, because we've been getting a couple of calls coming in, but this has really been an interesting conversation, and I've wanted to get some of these basic concepts out there. The Apple OS X is based on a kernel that's not the same, I understand, as Unix or Linux. It's called Mach.
Right.
And where is that, and what's the story behind the Mach kernel, and what makes that different, and how would it affect the underlying operating system?
Well, Mach is a kernel that was developed for the PowerPC platform several years ago, back in the early 90s. And its principles were that of a microkernel. And the difference between a microkernel and a monolithic kernel, which is the alternative, is that a microkernel is a very small, conceptually small piece of kernel software, which addresses the most fundamental drivers, the most fundamental aspects of system operation, and everything else that needs to interact with the kernel exists on a higher level in modules. So you can just take this tiny little bit of code to boot up the OS and then add everything else through modules.
Uh-huh.
Now, this means that there's a slight bit of performance hit, which anybody who's worked with object-oriented programming will know. This is kind of esoteric detail here. But if you do things that are object-oriented, it's really easy to develop them. It's easy to get your mind around them. But it's also slower. So it's a trade-off in terms of getting things to market quickly and making them work well versus making them really fast and optimized.
So there's a sacrifice in efficiency if you work in a modular way that gets things out the door quickly.
Yeah, having the Mach microkernel in there is very much in keeping with the way that Mac OS X is organized. If you've ever the way that they have they've organized their project builder, their bundle frameworks and all those things.
Yes, yes.
It's all designed to be as object-oriented as possible. Everything is visual. Everything is point-and-click, drag-and-drop. Now, this makes it really easy to write code. As WWDC attendees will know, you can write a text-edit application by just dragging a few pieces of code into place, and it's already done. You have copy and paste. You can embed movies in it. You can do anything you want because all the code is already there.
That's amazing.
You just have to point to them. Yeah, I don't know if it was Steve or somebody else on the stage just showed how you can make a movie player application in about 10 minutes, dragging together bits of pre-existing code.
So the Mach kernel itself is specifically compiled to run on Motorola processors,
right.
And it would be the Macintosh flavor, in this case, of a Unix
kernel.
But
it can, actually, I think it can run on x86, which I'm guessing just because there is Intel, there is an Intel version of Darwin.
Oh, yeah. Well, sure, because this all started out originally, I believe, at Next computer company, which was
right.
Steve Jobs' first gig after he got booted out of Apple.
Right.
And then when the next computer bombed, they continued with some version of the software that did run on the Intel platform.
Right, because at the time, Next was using the PowerPC, or actually at the time it was a 68K processor line.
Yeah.
And they wanted to run a BSD-like system on top of it, and they wanted to run a mock kernel on top of that. And that's where everything went with the Next operating system.
And this was more than 10 years ago. They were way ahead of their time.
This is 1989, 1990.
Yeah.
But what's happened is that they've inherited all the things that Next developed, and that includes both a PowerPC version of the operating system and an Intel version of the operating system. So what's really happened is macOS 10 is more Next than Apple in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a lot of people had a lot of trepidation about that when Jobs came back and immediately spent, $400 million or $700 million to buy the remains of Next.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's some disagreement as to which was the bigger company at the time.
Right.
They were both kind of beleaguered.
Really? Indeed. Totally. Let's, again, give those patient callers a chance to call in with their questions. The one or two people out there that are probably running FreeBSD or have some questions about this, 895-2448 or 1-800-499-7117. We promise we will get you on the air this time if you want to call back in with a question or a comment here on Point and Click Radio with our guest, Brian Thiemann, co-author of FreeBSD Unleashed. That's from Sam's Publishing. And when was the book published, Brian?
It was published in October. Actually, it was slated for mid-September, which you might imagine was thrown into a little bit of a whirlwind.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, you just, things change. Our priorities changed.
So it's been on the market for about 6 months now. And as far as I can tell, the sales are picking up slowly.
Oh, great.
Good.
Hi, caller. You're on the air.
Hi. Well, most of this is way over my head, but I was wondering, since I finally got through, if you can give me the number for the Ukiah Mac Users Group.
Oh, yes, I could. And thank you for calling and reminding me that I do want to mention that the Ukiah Mac Users Group is meeting next Monday, which would be 9, 10, 11, 12, 13th, Monday the 13th of May at Mendocino Community College. And if you want information about the Mac Users Group, call this number, 462-7175.
Great, thanks.
Okay, thanks for that call. Bye-bye. Well, it had nothing to do with BSD, but here comes another call. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi. Yep, I agree. It's way over my head, but it's really interesting hearing people talk about something I cannot understand at all.
Yeah. We're right there with you.
I'm a new Mac user, and I have a G4, and I have two questions for you.
We might only have time to get one of them in, but make it quick, okay?
Okay, a PDF file. I'm sending stuff to the journal to print, and it comes through without the fonts, and I want the fonts and the format kept when I email. And they have a Mac, but they don't get the formatting. How do I do a PDF file?
Are you using Mac OS X?
Yes.
You can create a PDF file in any program in Mac OS X that can print. There is in the print dialog box, there will be there is an option that says, I think, output settings or something like that, and it will allow you to save as PDF. And, when you activate that option, you, are basically able to save, print the document, quote unquote print the document as a PDF file that you can then email as an attachment.
Yeah, and we're going to have to cut you off at that point because we have one more call we want to squeeze in. But I would suggest checking your Mac online help. Just search for the term PDF, and you should get all kinds of instruction on how
absolutely.
To do that.
Thank you.
Good
okay,
luck.
Okay, bye-bye. 895-2448 or 1-800-499-7117. We've got time to squeeze in one more call. Do you have any other questions for Brian? Anything else you want to talk about, Brian?
The previous PDF comment was actually interesting because it illustrates one thing about Mac OS X.
Good point.
Which is that since Apple has the access to all these corporate, all these other kinds of technologies from Adobe, from Microsoft, and so on, now what you have is a Unix that can run Microsoft Word, a Unix that can use PDFs and run Photoshop.
Yeah.
Which was way up in the blue sky a couple years ago.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, Apple has turned Unix into very, very much of a mainstream operating system for, you know, ordinary computer users like us.
Right.
Would there be any point, Brian, for anybody using Mac OS X to learn any of the Unix commands or to try to get into using the terminal program?
If they want to learn how to run a server, that would be great.
Yeah. You mentioned Apache a little while ago. It comes bundled with Mac OS X.
Right.
Yeah.
And also, if they're interested in doing any development and programming for Unix, then that's also a great development platform for that.
But even for kind of, I mean, you know, semi-Mac power users, they're not program. They would consider themselves power users.
Oh, yeah.
Any advantages there to getting into the terminal and learning the command line interface for folks like that?
Sure. There's actually a lot of stuff you can do through the terminal. There's things you can do, like you can set your transparency on your terminal if you want. You can change your preferences around, delete files quickly. There's a lot of stuff that you can do more efficiently through the terminal than you can through the GUI.
Yeah.
So would this sort of be, in a rough way, a substitute for what people used to do in ResEdit on the original Mac OS?
Yes, actually it would.
They could kind of tweak things.
Now everything is in XML format, which is the plain text style format. Everything's in plists.
Wow.
Lists. So you can just edit those with a text editor.
And, of course, you could probably delete the entire contents of your hard drive if you're not
sure
careful.
You
so it's one of those things, just like ResEdit was, that you have to use a little bit of knowledge and caution.
Right. And you can also just use on any of the Unix tools that are very helpful for finding out how your system's running, like the top command.
Yeah, that's true. There are a lot of things in there that just kind of let you spy on your system and find out, you know, what processes are taking place and how things are working under the hood.
Right. Yeah. A lot of hidden power there.
So are we accurate in assuming that you're a Mac OS X user?
That's right, I am. Been using it since March 24th.
Cool.
Before that, actually, because I was using the...
We are out of time, Brian.
All right. Well,
the hour is up.
Pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for joining us.
Yes.
We want to thank Brian Thiemann, co-author of FreeBSD Unleashed, a 14-pound book from Sam's Publishing that has got to be a definitive guide to the FreeBSD operating system that comes with not one but two CD-ROMs. Thanks so much for taking the time to chat with us.
It's been great fun.
Okay. Have a good evening, Brian.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I understood a little bit of that.
Me too.
I understood a little bit of that, and I was fascinated even by the stuff I didn't understand, because it's just remarkable to know that, you know, to talk to someone who's in the trenches at this level and who knows all this stuff.
Yeah, and like you were saying earlier, alluding to the fact that even though most people won't ever install FreeBSD, a lot of the stuff is really going to make a lot of difference in the way people compute. I mean, if
Absolutely.
I had known about this stuff 10 years ago, you know, my whole understanding of how the computer field in general evolved over the last 10 years would have been totally different.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, we've got this 1,000-page book, and we've got, you know, someone like Brian who oftentimes talks in a language that even fairly sophisticated computer users like us have trouble understanding, yet at the end of the day, efforts like his and those like him have led to things like Mac OS X, which, you know, is running on the little iMac that you go out and buy at the local store. So that's kind of neat. That's ultimately where it all...
It is. It's like buying a Yugo and finding that the engine was made by Ferrari.
There you have it.
Up next is Jamie Roberts with Radiogram, 2 hours of spoken arts, theater, humor, and a whole lot more. I'm Bob Lawton.
And I'm Jim Hyde.
And we're going to sign off right now from Point and Click. That was a delightful interview. I'm really glad Brian could join us and enlighten us about, well, things like the difference between free software and open source software.
Yeah.
Amazing. The preceding portion of Point and Click Radio has been brought to you by the Homestyle Cafe in Fort Bragg, and you are tuned to KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Willits and Ukiah, K202BE 88.3 FM Fort Bragg, and good night, folks.
Good night, everybody.